Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American officials say the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is now secure after protesters set fires and breached the gatehouse today. Additional Marines have been temporarily sent for protection, but the State Department says personnel are safe, no plans to evacuate. The attack followed American airstrikes in Iraq and Syria this past weekend, which killed at least 24 Iraqi fighters in an Iranian-backed militia group. The U.S. says they killed an American contractor in Iraq last week. Today, President Trump tweeted that Iran orchestrated the embassy attack. Reuters reporter Ahmed Rashid is in Baghdad. Ahmed, you tell us this protest started after the funeral processions for some of those killed in the U.S. airstrikes. What happened?
So after the procession, we could see thousands of protesters and militia fighters crossed the key bridge which is leading to the U.S. embassy. Iraqi security forces have not prevented them from crossing, so they got very close and tried to storm the entrance. But security forces, the Iraqi security forces, prevented them.
What does it tell you, Ahmed, that Iraqi security forces let them get as close as they did? Where is the support lying here?
We tried to get a clear picture from the Iraqi security officials, but unfortunately none of them was willing to explain how could thousands of protester militia men manage to cross a key bridge and reach to the embassy without any effort by security forces to stop them. But you have put in consideration that we are talking about members of a very powerful militia groups.
Well, could you remind us of the split that feeds into this? We're well aware there's a Sunni-Shia tension. The Iraqi government is Sunni-backed. Iran is Shia, and these were said to be Iranian-backed Shiite militias. Talk about that tension.
Well, we are talking simply about Iranian-backed powerful militia groups. They have representation in the Iraqi parliament and members also incorporated to the government security forces. So this explains the broad authority they have to achieve their goals.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about the position this puts the Iraqi government in, because there was a statement from the office of the Iraqi prime minister today that said aggression against foreign embassies would be punished. But he's also said earlier that those American airstrikes, which again killed these Iranian-backed militia members in Iraq, violated his country's sovereignty. Now, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke with the Iraqi prime minister today and then issued a statement saying the United States will protect and defend its people. So you have the U.S. saying they have a right to retaliate against the death of a contractor. And the attack was against an Iranian-backed militia, but it was on Iraqi soil, and it was Iraqis who were killed.
Yes, the Prime Minister, Adel Abdel Mehdi, is in a very critical situation. He's facing a very powerful militia group who, as I told you, they have a heavy weight inside the government, also in the political life. Same time, he just wants to make it clear to the Americans that he will not allow any hostility actions toward the United States interest in Iraq. But when you see the situation on the ground, it's very obvious that Adel Abdel Mehdi is incapable of reining in or controlling the Iranian-backed militia groups. Today, he issued a statement asking them to leave the premises of the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. And political sources also say that he just asked the key militia commander to give orders to their men on the ground near the embassy to retreat back, but they refused.
That's Reuters reporter Ahmed Rashid in Baghdad. Ahmed, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Here in the U.S., new census figures show population growth is at its slowest pace since the end of World War I, growing just half a percentage point over 1 year. William Fry is senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And William, this slow growth is driven in part by a drop in immigration. Just under 600,000 immigrants were added to the population this year. What's happening?
Yeah, you know, we've had ups and downs in immigration really over the last decade. Just 3 years ago, we had over 1 million immigrants coming to the U.S. I think, you know, some of the new restrictions on immigration had something to do with it. But it is an unusually low number. We haven't seen the low number of less than 600,000 for quite a while in the United States. So I wouldn't say this is a long-term trend. I would say that part of it is mostly a blip.
Let's also talk about the fertility rate. We've been hearing about this for quite a while, but what do we know about how many children Americans are having and how big of a factor this is in this number?
Sure. I mean, earlier this year, we've learned that the net reproduction rate, which is the average number of children that women have over their childbearing years, has gone down again. It's been a constant decline in the last few years. We also see that there is a delay in childbearing. It continues to be a decline in women in their 20s having children and somewhat of an uptick of women in their 30s having children. And so this kind of putting off of having children is part of what we see some of this decline. I think a bit of this has to do with the famed millennial population who are still trying to get out from under the Great Recession of 10 years ago in terms of moving on with their lives, getting jobs, buying homes, having families. And so, again, I think although we'll see a longer term moderation of fertility in the United States, this may be a little bit of a blip downward because of the continued issues with that millennial generation.
And thinking about the regional differences and what we're seeing population wise, where are you seeing the biggest changes?
Well, the biggest gains are in the Mountain West and in the Southeast. If you look at the fastest growing states over the last year with these new numbers, you see Idaho, Nevada, Arizona, and Utah being the top fastest growing areas. But soon after that is Texas, South Carolina, Washington, Colorado, Florida, and North Carolina rounding out the top 10. So there's a lot of migration moving inward from California. We didn't talk about California, but California has shown a dip in its growth over the last 10 years. Not as high growth in some of the northeastern states. You know, this is continued kind of a movement from the snow belt to the sun belt, but also in the case of California, moving away from kind of a pricey, high cost of living area to maybe places around California where the cost of living is a little lower and it's the economy's picking up a little bit.
Can we bring in politics here? Some of the states losing populations, as you mentioned, including blue states like California, while red sunbelt states like Idaho, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, and Texas, as you mentioned, are gaining population. With the census taking place next year, do you expect these population shifts are going to result in political changes in terms of congressional representation?
Yeah, the 2020 census, of course, is the basis of making this reapportionment of Congress. And, you know, as I see it from the calculations I've done with the standard formula, Texas could gain 3 seats, Florida could gain 2 seats. California fairly likely could lose a seat for the first time in its history. So that's kind of interesting. You might think this is only going to favor red states, but some red states are going to be losing a seat by these projections as well. Alabama, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, all states that voted for President Trump in the 2016 election, as well as West Virginia, will lose seats according to this. And there'll be a couple of blue states that might gain seats, including Oregon and Colorado. So, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag. The other thing to think about here, though, is that you might think that Texas being a red state and Arizona being a red state, you could look ahead and say the Republicans are going to be in pretty good shape over the next 10 years, which, of course, how these reapportionments last. But some of the people moving into those states are likely people who might vote Democratic, a lot of Hispanics, a lot of African Americans in the case of North Carolina, and maybe some blue state migrants moving to these areas. So it's hard to predict the actual political implications of all of this, but the demography does show a continued movement to the Sun Belt and more into the Mountain West, just like the overall population's trends are going.
Yeah, you're someone who thinks about
population a lot. And of course, you've talked about the political implications and ramifications, perhaps. But what would you tell someone wondering why all of this matters if the population grows at a slow rate?
Well, you know, certainly you don't want to have a loss of population, and there actually were 10 states that lost population last year. That's not so good. But an underlying implication of a declining population or even a slow-growing population, as it is in the U.S., is there's an increased aging of our population. There is this big generation of baby boomers, all of whom are going to be past age 65 by the year 2030, 10 years from now. They're going to be dependent on the success and productivity of the younger labor force. And the big safety valve in all of this is immigration. You know, a lot of our decline of births, or at least slow growth of births, can be countered by immigration from abroad. And so immigration is going to be a much bigger part of our growth. So this is something to pay attention to as we move ahead into the next decade. What is our immigration policy going to be? How are immigrants going to fit into the rest of our society and the rest of our economy?
William Fry is a demographer and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. William, thank you for joining us.
Sure, I enjoyed it.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
Good morning, starshine. Earth says hello.
Recently, some old friends gathered for a reunion at a restaurant along New York Central Park, and as friends do, began singing an old favorite, halting at first. But pretty soon, some other patrons noticed, hey, isn't that the cast of the 1979 movie Hair? Hair was first a mega-hit Broadway musical in 1968 with music by Galt McDermott and lyrics by Jerome Ragney and James Rado. Then the beloved movie in 1979. It tells the story of a small band of flower children dropping out in Central Park during the Vietnam War, loosely led by George Berger, played by Treat Williams, who organized this reunion. When you all meet up with each other, it feels real. It feels as if you had become a tribe.
It's like being back with your family. We were very, very close. We know each other very, very well. We all were grateful and happy to see each other.
Well, and how about grateful to be in that movie?
It's the highest movie on my list. It's number one. I'm deeply grateful that I got a chance to be in it.
This is the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. Age of Aquarius.
The songs, like Aquarius, sung by Wren Woods. And Hair, sung by Donnie Dacus of the band Chicago, Dorsey Wright, and Treat Williams, all at this reunion, topped the charts, blared from radios. They were sung around the world. They still are. We understand that Hair is one of the most produced pieces in high schools. I mean, yeah. It has this life. Why do you think that is?
I think it's about kids finding their strength and their independence. I think it was why it was so successful in Eastern Europe, because anybody who feels repressed, and most kids between 14 and 18 feel repressed in certain ways, and I think it was about kind of breaking out and finding yourself. I think that's part of it.
At the restaurant, the still luminescent Beverly D'Angelo, who played a young high society woman who joins the tribe, offered up a toast to their younger selves.
That part of us that was way back there and to bring out that innocence and beauty that we embodied then. And I'm so happy to see all of you are alive and well, and it's wonderful.
Here, here.
Good one, Beverly. Okay.
There's more love during that year in my life from everybody, and we all put up with each other, and we all were like a family and a tribe, and here we are. So,
to Milos.
Here's to Milos.
Milos.
Milos would be the Czech director Milos Forman, who died in 2018. His One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest won Best Picture Oscar in 1974. Hair was the movie he wanted to make next. His family lived under both Nazi and communist occupation. Do you think he brought something about repression and freedom?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think that theme is rampant throughout Milos's films. I mean, his parents were both murdered by the Nazis. He grew up in a very repressive environment in his country, in Czechoslovakia. And it wasn't until he left Czechoslovakia and became famous here that he could actually go back and make a film there, which was Amadeus. So I think that this really spoke to him.
Yeah.
Because it was not something that kids his age were ever able to do, which was to express themselves freely.
Yeah. It was really quite tender to hear all of you talking about your love of Milos Forman. What?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. We all realized we were in the presence of a true artist. If we weren't being real, he would always say, no, it's not real. He was loving. I mean, he was the kind of director we all wish for.
Oh.
There comes trouble.
Claude Bukowski,
played by actor John Savage, who happens to be my brother, arrives.
Let the sun shine.
Claude was the innocent from Oklahoma, headed for boot camp. At the same time, John was also playing the soldier Stephen in The Deer Hunter, the definitive Vietnam War movie, so playing two lost souls shipped off to Vietnam. His childhood friend Jeff Miller was killed at Kent State. John had little kids, but other friends were drafted. You'd think the two movies at once would be too much.
Oh, it was completely acceptable. I really felt like I was doing one movie. It was my life. Is what I had all around me. Friends that were being shot at home for demonstrating. It was disturbing. And then people coming back with PTS. So, I don't know.
Where do I go? Follow the river. Where do I go? Follow the gulls.
He's such a beautiful actor. I never had a chemistry with a male actor like I had with John.
Bukowski!
Well, spoiler alert, they also shared a plot twist, one that moved Hare way beyond a fun-filled Flower Children festival. At the end of the movie, Treat's hippie Burger convinces John's soldier Claude to trade places at the army base to give Claude a day off. But it backfires, and it's Burger, dressed as Claude, who goes to war.
And I'm in, and the guy says, okay, we're going, you're going, we're all going. And they're driving us to put our stuff on and get going. And the camera pushes in on me, and I remember thinking, well, I'm like a caged animal. So I started making these almost whimpering sounds.
Manchester, England, England.
Were you terrified? This is 1979, we already know. The horror of Vietnam and what happened at the end in 50,000
I was terrified in the 60s when I was waiting for my number to be called. And I remember sitting at my parents' kitchen table by myself with a six-pack of beer, and my number came up 347, so I didn't have to go. I was terrified that night.
Back in New York, the reunited tribe made its way to Central Park, site of the iconic Be-Ins and Love-Ins, choreographed by Twyla Tharp. Annie Golden, the impossibly hopeful flower child genie, now has the role of Norma, the mute singer in Orange is the New Black, which she traces to Milos picking her out of the punk rock band The Shirts.
Yeah, he came to CBGB's because that was the scene. He likes unknowns. He likes raw diamonds. And he picked me for Jeannie.
I met a boy called Frank Mills on September 12th right here in front of the Waverly.
Yeah, it was life-changing. And then I get Orange is the New Black, and it was Jenji Cohen who had seen Hair as a child, and she said, That woman should be, you know, she should be a household name. Everything kind of unfolded.
Straight up, honey, where the trees are.
They made their way through Central Park, finding old locations.
Yep, this is where we burned the draft cards. I mean, I can remember every single day of shooting of that film.
And could you believe it's been 40 years?
I can't. What I'm loving is that it seems to have a life still.
The next day, the tribe made its way to the Avon Theater in Stamford, Connecticut, Treat's hometown, for a raucous, sold-out screening of Hair, with sing-alongs and a panel.
I didn't know who that man was.
Actor Dorsey Wright spoke of being an African-American kid from the South Bronx who didn't even know who director Milos Forman was until he saw an Oscar on his mantle.
This is yours? And it said, one flew over the cuckoo's nest. And the hell with you. You know Jack Nicholson?
Dorsey also spoke tearfully of how Treat and Milos guided him. Donnie Dacus talked about ignoring calls from the filmmakers.
And so basically hung up on everybody, honestly, because I thought they were just harassing me.
John Savage has become a close friend to veterans groups. He travels the world for both Deer Hunter and Hare. Just recently, he was invited to the former communist country Serbia, which was mounting its first stage version of Hare. John burst into tears on stage.
And the music and the spirit, mostly, transcended language all over the world, countries I went to. Oh, you're American. Let the sun shine in.
My late husband was in the Army from 1965 to 1967, and that aspect of the movie really, really hit hard. I'm still trembling, actually.
It is a thrill to have you here and to look at you. I took the Hair soundtrack to college with me. I've spent more time listening to you guys sing, playing it over and over.
What I honor is how generous everybody was. John, Dorsey, Annie, Donnie, everybody was so generous. Everybody wanted it to be good, and I loved it, and I'll always love it. Oh, I never wanted a role so much in my life as this. Nor since, by the way. Nor since.
Actor Treat Williams. We also heard from actors John Savage, Beverly D'Angelo, Annie Golden, Dorsey Wright, Donnie Dacus, The Tribe, and the Milos Forman film Hair, 40 years old this year, with music from Galt McDermott, screenplay from Jerome Ragney, James Rado, and Michael Weller, based on the 60s musical. We'll have videos and pictures at hereandnow.org. We'd love to have your thoughts. What did this movie mean to you? And I know, I'm partial, I know that, but I highly recommend, if you haven't seen it, stream this film. The usually staid world of auto manufacturing took a page out of a Jason Bourne movie today as Carlos Ghosn, the former top executive of Renault and Nissan, escaped house arrest in Tokyo and fled to Beirut, where he's being welcomed home as a celebrity. Ghosn was arrested in Japan in November 2018 on charges he'd improperly used Nissan funds to finance his lush lifestyle. He'd always maintained his innocence. Let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. So, Mike, the speculation is some money changed hands to enable him to get out. But take us back. Renault, French, Nissan, Japanese, Ghosn, brought on by Renault 20 years ago to turn Nissan around. The two automakers, operating as a partnership. Things started to go sour about a year ago. What exactly is Ghosn accused of?
So, Robin, this basically stems from about a decade ago. Japan started requiring companies to disclose to the public how much executives are being paid. So the original allegations against Ghosn was that in order to sort of avoid a public backlash, not only in Japan but also in France, He wanted to avoid a backlash to this exorbitant sums that he was being paid by the company. So he allegedly tried to hide about $140 million worth of compensation from being publicly disclosed. That was sort of the main gist of the case. Then after that, other charges have been tacked on, including that he transferred some losses from the foreign exchange market from his personal accounts to Nissan's, and that he redirected some $5 million from Nissan into personal accounts. So they've sort of thrown a lot of charges onto that that original one.
But he says he's not fled justice. He's escaped injustice and a rigged Japanese system, 99% of charges ending conviction in Japan, according to official Japanese numbers. So, I mean, he thinks he's right, but do others?
Well, this case certainly is drawing a lot of international scrutiny to the Japanese justice system. As you pointed out, it's almost impossible for a defendant to beat a criminal charge in Japan. Close to 100% conviction rate among prosecutors. And in many cases, the prosecution can introduce evidence that they actually obtained without a proper warrant, which is obviously unheard of in the West. And in Ghosn's case, there were some very strict bail conditions that almost seemed cruel. He was only allowed limited contact with his wife and that sort of thing. So without sort of weighing in on whether he's innocent or guilty, there certainly is a lot of scrutiny being drawn to the Japanese system because of this case.
Well, we only have about a minute. What happens to the companies? Because the chief executive of Nissan allegedly told Renault that this all started because Nissan employees went rogue. They wanted to keep Nissan independent. I mean, what's going to happen to the companies?
Well, there certainly is a lot of tension between the two. As you said, there's a partnership. Renault owns about 43% of Nissan, while Nissan owns about 15% of Renault. So it's sort of an imbalance there, and there has been a lot of tension over this relationship. Ghosn's attorney actually has described the whole thing as an orchestrated coup to get him out of the top spot and presumably to sort of fend off Renault's control of the company.
Yeah, well, meanwhile, he's been reunited with his wife and his vineyard in Lebanon, but assumptions are, you know, forfeited millions that he posted in bail and maybe handed out millions more to get out of the country.
Right.
We'll follow this story with Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
This year proved to be a big one for technology. There were scientific milestones and innovative triumphs, as well as some spectacular scandals. Joining me now for a look back at the year in tech is Jessica Lessen, founder and editor-in-chief of The Information. Hello, Jessica.
Hello, Tanya.
And also with us is Christina Passariello, editor overseeing the Washington Post technology coverage. Hi, Christina.
Hi, Tanya.
Okay, so I think it's safe to say this was the year that a big contingent of people really began to understand artificial intelligence and machine learning and how it plays in our daily lives. This month, LinkedIn actually named artificial intelligence specialist as the job with the largest rate of hiring growth from 2015 through this year. Jessica, do you think 2019 was a tipping point for artificial intelligence?
I do in many ways, and it's spreading behind the scenes as well. I think what we see in covering AI at The Information is not just the services consumers use and think about, like Siri and similar devices, but really the way that AI is changing everything we do, from customer service to shopping and a lot of the back end behind the scenes things as well. So absolutely a big year, and I think much more to come.
Yeah. You know, another big story that we heard a lot about at the beginning of 2019 was WeWork. It was valued at $47 billion at the beginning of 2019. Now its CEO is out and it's worth a fraction of that. Christina, what does this particular rise and fall of WeWork tell us about tech in 2019 and what does it really signify moving forward?
Well, WeWork was actually just one of the several giant startups that had the shine taken off of it this year. WeWork was certainly one of the biggest, but if you look at Uber, for instance, or Lyft, Uber's valuation has sunk to about a half of what it started off at back in May. This business model of, you know, growth at any cost and don't worry about profits
doesn't really sit well with the broader public, the kind of business model that venture capital has backed for so long has really come under question this year.
Absolutely. And part of it is realizing that not every company that told investors it was a technology company is really a technology company. It might just be a great real estate business or a great transportation business. And I think that lens is definitely on the mind of investors going into 2020, where we're going to see a number of companies try to hit the public markets for the first time, Airbnb among them. I think how investors are going to view that is still a very open and very important question for the technology markets.
I think another big story that we heard over and over at different companies, really the rise of the tech worker. We saw a lot of workers speaking out against the actions of their employers. We know last year tens of thousands of Google employees walked off the job to protest the company's handling of sexual harassment allegations. But then that story really continued because a lot of employees were alleging that the company retaliated against them for their activism. And then there was Amazon and Uber and Lyft. Christina, what do you make of labor organizing among tech workers now? And what did this year show us?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The discord among tech workers and their discontent has been one of the major stories for this year. What the Google story shows us is a real cultural shift at the company. It's a company that was founded on these principles of transparency and everybody can talk about whatever they want at work. And as they've realized, that doesn't work very well when you're a giant company with 100,000 workers. So the kinds of worker movement we're seeing at Google, also a little bit at Amazon, is distinct from what we're seeing among gig workers. And we're seeing kind of like two different movements among workers. One,
and that distinction is important. Yeah.
Yeah. Like one from these, you know, white collar workers who are direct employees of tech giants and who disagree with the companies, maybe for their internal communications, the way that they are dealing with certain things internally, or also the way that they have accepted AI contracts, for instance, to help the Defense Department or the application of their technologies. Then what we're seeing among Uber workers, Lyft workers, Instacart workers, those workers are really speaking out against these gig companies.
Yeah, Jessica, I'm wondering from you, you know, this is a story that has picked up steam this year, but it's really been building over the last couple of years. Will we actually see change in the way companies operate because of the demands of the employees and these gig workers who are pushing for change?
Yeah, an excellent question. And, you know, when we broke the story around the sexual harassment allegations against Andy Rubin, which were really the tip of this that has galvanized so many Google workers. We could not have predicted that I think it would have seen this level of activism. I think it's here to stay. I've been surprised that it sort of permeated the boardrooms of the earliest stage startups as well. So will it change the way they operate? I think in the short term, it's going to sort of paralyze the companies more than evolve them. I think if you look at Google right now, you have a CEO in Sundar Pichai, now the CEO of the whole parent company, Alphabet, who's a little bit just under fire, a little bit of, you know, doesn't know which way to move. And you hear from some groups within these companies a concern that paralysis in the fast-moving field of technology could hold people back.
Of course, another big story we followed this year is the renewed interest in antitrust regulation. In July, the FTC approved a record $5 billion fine against Facebook for privacy violations, and the Justice Department is looking into Facebook. But we haven't seen as much action yet as you might think with all of this talk about breaking up these big tech companies. Christina, where do we stand on antitrust as we head into 2020?
Yeah, I think certainly it seems like it's a very long process and one that is really only beginning. If we look to Europe, where they have been attacking tech companies on antitrust for much longer, we see that those are very long investigations. They take years. And then by the time that there's some
fine or action against the company. The company has tended to evolve so much that it's a little bit out of date. We've seen that with Google as well. So it would be interesting to see the ways in which, you know, American regulators are learning from what has worked and also not worked in Europe.
Hmm. Well, that's a good point. That's a good point about the timeline and perhaps the realities versus what we expect to see several years versus, you know, a year or two. We've just really been talking about this. I want to ask you also about something else, both Christina and Jessica, about the increased scrutiny this year on social media giants for privacy violations and political activity. In May, Facebook banned InfoWars and lots of other right-wing sites, and the Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. And President Trump has accused the company of censorship against conservatives. How are tech companies handling those issues as we head into 2020? I'll start with you, Jessica.
Poorly, I might say. And there are some stark differences. You know, I mean, Facebook is really holding the line on trying to, quote, not pick sides. And so, you know, we're seeing YouTube also wrestle with this very, very deeply. I think YouTube has been quicker to remove some content and to kind of intervene. But, you know, it's interesting, I think, when companies and CEOs like Mark Zuckerberg say, we actually want some regulation on this point because we can't, you know, we shouldn't be making each one of these rules on our own. I think there's some truth to that. And so it'll be very interesting to watch how a company navigates it. And if this is a place where in the U.S. you'll see, you know, more legislation for guidance, or whether, you know, these decisions are still going to be made on a very case-by-case basis by a very small number of people.
Yeah, I would, and I think that we can't underestimate like how consequential this is going to be next year in the context of the election.
Yes.
Because we've come such a far way since 2016 in understanding the ways that the platforms can be misused. But there are still not clear remedies for those kinds of things. And there's very much the impression that the same kind of manipulation is already going on.
Yep.
And this is going to just be a really, really big issue going into the election.
That's Jessica Lessen, founder and editor-in-chief of The Information, and Washington Post technology editor Christina Passariello. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you.
Let's catch up now with fire-ravaged Australia. Flames lashing a rescue truck in Australia, where brush fires have claimed at least 12 lives since October. Today, the government said it would send the military to help fight more than 100 fires raging in the southeastern states of New South Wales and Victoria. In the coastal town of Mallacoota, popular with tourists, thousands of people sought shelter on the beach and in boats as fires turned the sky bright orange. Shane Fitzsimmons, commissioner of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, called it the worst fire season the region has ever seen.
These fires have spread faster and further than the modelling and the fire weather predictions suggested they would. It's been a truly awful day, not just for firefighters, but clearly for the families, for the communities, for those that are holidaying down on the south coast.
Yeah. Of course, we'll continue to follow the flames and the heat in Australia. But meanwhile, to the role of art in hospitals here in the U.S. Museum walls carry Picasso, Monet, other masters. In medical settings, the master's name is Domke. Sebastian Martinez Valdivia of KBIA went to central Missouri to track down the man who's the source of thousands of images you see in America's hospitals.
I want to level it, make sure it's really sharp.
Henry Domke is lining up a shot. His target? The vibrant petals of a red buckeye bloom. Domke is a retired family doctor who's been photographing the wildlife in his backyard for years. When he was still practicing, he decorated his office with his photos. And after he retired, he started exhibiting his work. At one show,
some people from Blessing Hospital in Quincy, Illinois, came and saw the work and bought 40 large prints, boom, like that.
From that point on, Domke developed his hobby into a business, And today, his photographs are in more than 2,000 hospitals and clinics from Connecticut to California. The business sells hundreds of thousands of dollars in prints each year. Domke's work is popular in part because of his subject matter. Domke photographs flowers, plants, and other images of nature from his backyard, a 540-acre preserve he finances through his business.
More than once, people would say to me, "How did you find my grandfather's farm? You know, you took this picture where I played as a kid." Well, it's not what it was, but that's what it triggered a memory.
And that's what healthcare designers and architects look for. Within the niche world of healthcare design, Domke is a big name. He sells $500,000 or more of his artwork in a typical year and has installations in 45 states.
His work is international. It is all over. I always use a Domke.
Rosalind Kama is president of a Connecticut design studio specializing in evidence-based design. That's a movement in the design world that uses research to improve patient health. For example, one foundational study found that patients recovering from surgery in rooms with a view of a grove of trees had shorter hospital stays than those with views of brick walls. Other research has borne out the benefit of nature images as well.
So, for instance, you know, in the case of art, we want to create positive distractions in environments.
Kama says research shows that images of nature are the most effective in distracting and relaxing patients. And that's why Domke's work is so popular. For example, she tells me about a cancer ward she designed. The treatment area was in a basement with little natural light, so Kama took Domke's photos of local flowers and seashells and stretched them out on canvas to decorate the ward.
And we felt that the immediate connection to nature would sort of calm that nervous response of going in for treatment and coming out, sort of creating that exhale that one needs.
So here's a couple large pieces you can see from Domke that was brought in with our cancer center. One of the
Blessing Hospital uses Domke's work in a couple different ways. The hospital serves a rural area along the Mississippi River, so finding the right art for hallways and exam rooms was crucial, as facilities director Jane Fry explains.
So you do see in our artwork a lot of things that are representative of our region, that which is familiar and represents our community and those we serve.
For Domke, that meant photographing flowers, trees, and landscapes from the area, like a flowering dogwood or a coneflower. But Blessing's use of his work goes beyond hanging prints on walls.
So there's another one, beautiful texture.
Fry shows off new patient rooms where Domke's photos cover walls from floor to ceiling, and miniature copies are printed next to the room number on the outside to help patients find their way. Back at his preserve, Domke says he has feedback from patients that his approach can work. He recalls a note from a cancer patient who was getting treatments at Blessing and would come in early to sit in front of one of his works.
It was a print of an oak tree with light coming through from behind, kind of glowing, and you could see the rays of light. And she said she would go into prayer there before her therapy, chemotherapy, and that it just sort of had religious implications to her. She felt the presence of God, so if my work can help people to experience that, I mean, that's lucky.
For Here and Now, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
And that story came from Side Effects Public Media. I'm Robin Young. I'll be here tomorrow. Tanya, I wish you and Jeremy a happy new year.
Same to you. I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.
Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts would preside over President Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate. What exactly does that mean? Well, he could rule on evidence and witnesses, but he could also defer to the Republican Senate majority on trial procedures. What an impeachment trial might look like, next time, Here and Now.